Welcome to this IFRS Foundation podcast. It's been 2 months since our last podcast because there was no meeting of the International Accounting Standards Board during August. There was one in September, and that took place in London on the 20th and 21st of September 2017. My name is Matt Tilling, and I'm the Director of Education here at the Foundation. I'm together with Chair of the Board, Hans Hugewurst, and Vice Chair, Sue Lloyd. Hans, I thought it would make sense to kick off with mentioning that the Board looks a little different compared to the last time we met.
Yes, two of our Board members finished their second and last terms during June and July. Stephen Cooper, our British Board member, and our Chinese Board member, Wei Guozhang. And at the September meeting, we had three new members around the table. From the UK, Nick Anderson, who used to be a buy-side investor. It's the first buy-side investor that we have at the table. And Ann Tarka from Australia, who used to be an academic. And then a new Chinese board member, Jen Chao Lu, who joins us from the Chinese Ministry of Finance and who we know very well because he used to be a member of ASEF and even worked at the ISB at an early stage of his career. So the board is now complete for the first time in a long time. We have 14 members now and are all set to go.
And before we go on to this month's board meeting, could you give us an update on the latest publication by the board that came out earlier this month?
Yeah, earlier this month we issued an important document, a so-called practice statement on the application of materiality. A practice statement is a non-mandatory piece of guidance. It's only the second time that we have issued a document like that. First time was management commentary practice statement in 2010. So while it is non-mandatory, it is developed using the same due process as we follow when developing standards, i.e. with consultations and with public board discussions. I believe it's an important document. It will be a very useful tool for companies in making materiality judgments, which traditionally has always been very difficult. It brings together all the materiality requirements in our standards. And I believe it should really help facilitate, improve communication between preparers and investors by making sure that the focus of the financial statements is on the information that really matters as opposed to less relevant information. So a byproduct of this document can hopefully be that there will be a reduction in the clutter caused by lots of immaterial information.
And linked to this, we also published an exposure draft that proposes some clarifications to the definition of material.
Yeah, we see that as essentially a housekeeping matter. We are bringing in some of the more helpful wording from elsewhere in the IFRS literature into the definition of materiality itself. Hopefully it will clarify materiality further for preparers.
Sue, let's move on to the board's discussions. The hottest topic was perhaps primary financial statements.
Yes, yeah, so this project is one of our key areas of focus at the moment, and it's a really important part of the work that we're doing under the sort of banner of better communication and financial statements. We had a good discussion, and I think we really moved forward on this project this month. The first thing that the board agreed to was that we should focus in the first instance on defining an EBIT measure for this income statement with the objective of improving comparability between entities. We know it's an important metric for investors. And that once we've done that, we'll circle back and discuss again the management operating profit metric. The other thing we agreed to do was to propose introducing an investing category into the income statement that would be above the EBIT subtotal. We need to do some more work on how we would define that category, but the idea would be that, for example, the returns on investments in marketable securities would be presented in this part of the income statement. And we also discussed the analysis of expenses that would be shown on the face of the income statement and agreed that there should continue to be a choice between two different approaches. The primary cut should either be an analysis by nature or an analysis by function. But we also decided that it wouldn't be a free choice so much, but rather a choice that would be made based on criteria such as what would provide the most useful information to the users of a particular entity's financial statements.
And there were also three education sessions this month at the board.
Yes, that's right. The first one was rate regulated activities. So we continued our discussion on the direction of that project. And what we were talking about in some detail this month was some aspects of the measurement of the regulatory asset or liability. And in particular, we were having a discussion about how the effect of the time value of money might be included in the measurement of those amounts, such as when an entity incurs expenses and then gets reimbursed for that by an increase in the regulatory rate over a number of years. Another area that we looked at from an research perspective and an education session was business combinations under common control. This is an important topic, particularly with the security regulators. They're very keen that we do some work on this. And it's a project we've been working on for a while and that we confirmed as part of the agenda consultation last year. And we haven't been looking at this for a little while, and we picked it up again this week. And so it was a bit of an update to remind us on the work we'd done so far and the decisions we'd made previously on scope. And the board also discussed a little bit what we want to talk about in the future, for example, considering whether we should prescribe a single method to account for all business combinations under common control, or whether we might prescribe different approaches in different circumstances. So the staff will bring us back some more analysis on those topics. And the last set of education sessions was on dynamic risk management. The staff have been taking us through a whole series of education sessions to make sure that we understand the background for how interest rate risk is managed by banks. And the good news for us is that we finished our education on this topic this month, and so now we've got the foundations to enable us to move forward discussing sort of possible approaches to the actual accounting.
And the board takes no decisions during these education sessions?
Yeah, basically that's the only difference. If you watch one of these meetings, it's a discussion in the normal way, and the only difference is we're not really asked to vote on particular decisions.
Hans, the board also discussed the conceptual framework. Where are we at with this?
Yes, as you know, we have already finished our deliberations on the conceptual process, and the staff is now in the process of drafting the final revised conceptual framework. This week we discussed some of the comments that we received from people who are reviewing the draft of the revised conceptual framework, and we decided it would be useful to clarify that in some cases a trade-off may be needed between how much measurement uncertainty is acceptable in relation to how relevant a particular measure is. Let me take you through an example that should clarify it. Say that we are accounting for an equity investment that is not actively traded in a market, so the price is difficult to determine, and it also has highly uncertain cash flows. So that is an investment of which the value is extremely difficult to measure. Fair value may be the most relevant information for such an instrument, but as I said, determining the fair value for such an instrument may be subject to high measurement uncertainty. You simply don't know exactly. On the other hand, cost really doesn't provide relevant information for such an equity investment. So despite the high measurement uncertainty associated with fair value in this case, we still think that fair value is the most relevant measurement basis for such an investment. So this goes to show that you have to really make a good weighing between relevance and measurement uncertainty. We are working to finalize the draft of the conceptual framework and hope to publish it early next year.
Sue, do you want to cover any of the implementation-related discussions?
Yeah, we had a few different discussions, but they're quite techie, so what I'll stick to is one that I think is a particularly interesting topic. Mm-hmm. And what the board's trying to do is to think of ways to assist preparers when they've decided to voluntarily change their accounting policies as a result of new information that's provided by an agenda decision which is issued by the Interpretations Committee. And we know sometimes when these voluntary changes are made that making those changes retrospectively can be quite burdensome, and the standard hurdle that we've got in IS8 to decide whether or not you need to reflect a change in policy using retrospective or prospective application is a very high hurdle of impracticability. So what the board's really working on is some proposed amendments to IAS 8 to be a little bit kinder, I guess, in terms of determining when retrospective application is really required, when a change in policy comes as a result of an agenda decision of our Interpretations Committee. And what we've been talking about is making a change to IAS 8 to say that in those circumstances, rather than using impracticability, the entity would consider whether the benefits of retrospective application outweigh the costs. So basically, we'd be lowering the hurdle that would be needed to be passed. And so the board has basically agreed on pursuing that approach and proposing an amendment to IS8 to try and help preparers on that front.
And those agenda decisions can be quite useful and helpful in preparing financial statements. They're available, obviously, on the website. And they're also included in the annotated IFRS standards.
Yeah, in the green book, yes, that's right. The IFRS Interpretations Committee, I think the name Interpretations Committee makes people think that, you know, all we do is issue interpretations. And in fact, the Interpretations Committee does a range of things. Sometimes it does do standard setting, so makes amendments, narrow scope amendments to the standards or issues interpretations. But often when the committee decides that it's not necessary to undertake standard setting because there's already sufficient guidance in our standards for people to be able to apply the requirements, the committee, when it issues the agenda decision, will try and include as much helpful information as they can for people to guide them through the application of our standards and to remind them of what the relevant requirements are to answer questions and what, for example, the disclosure requirements might be. But it's apparent there's lots of confusion about the agenda decisions and the role of the committee. And actually, to help with that communication of the role of the committee, we've put together a short video and a leaflet which tries to explain better how the committee works and how it fits into the bigger picture of maintenance and support for IFRS standards. And we've put that information on a dedicated part of our website for people to try and improve our own communication.
So Hans, quite a range of topics were discussed, and next week there will be a lot more discussion going on.
Yes, next week will be a very busy one. We will start on Monday with our annual gathering of standard setters from all over the world. The so-called World Standard Setters meeting brings together over 100 people from more than 50 jurisdictions. Always a very enjoyable meeting and a very important event for us to reach out to standard setters around the world. Later on that week, we will also have a meeting with IFAS, which is an organization of standard setters themselves. And we will always participate very actively in that meeting. And at the end of the week, we will close with a meeting with ASEF, this time only one day. Normally it's 2 days. ASEF, as you know, our most important advisory body on our standard setting activities. So a lot of meetings. I will also have a lot of bilateral meetings with standard setters in that week. So a very important week for relationship building of the IASB.
And it doesn't stop then. The following week, you're off to Dubai?
Yes, so the travel season has also started again. We have a conference in Dubai in early October, and I encourage everybody, people in the Middle East, to come that to that conference. Immediately following this conference, I will travel to Australia at a conference organized by the National Standard Setter. And at the same time, we will also have our first virtual conference, on the internet, organized together with the ICAEW on the new leases standard. And then finally, in November, we have another of our IFRS conferences, this time in Toronto, in Canada, which we organized together with the standard setter there. And I will be going to that conference as well. So I will be accumulating a lot of jet lag in the next 2 months.
Well, on that note, that brings us to the end of the September podcast. Thank you, Sue and Hans, and thank you to our listeners. Any feedback on these podcasts, please email communications@ifrs.org. As always, the full summary of the board's discussion and decisions at the September meeting can be found in the ISB update on the IFRS Foundation's website. Thank you all.